Enjoy this conversation with a lifelong learner and osteopathic enthusiast. Welcome to episode 98 of the Osteopathic Manipulative Medicine Podcast, where we share clinical stories and pearls related to osteopathic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ben Green, a third-year osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine resident at Michigan State University. Our guest this evening began her path to practicing osteopathic primary care sports medicine with a Bachelor's of Science in Interdisciplinary Health Sciences from the University of Illinois. She continued her passion for looking at patient care from a 360-degree perspective at Kansas City University, where she completed the DO MBA dual degree program. In addition, she was selected for the undergraduate OMM fellowship at KCU, where she was able to pursue multiple passions, including teaching and dancing for the Major Arena Soccer League team, the Kansas City Comets. She completed her family medicine residency at the University of Michigan Health West while participating in both the osteopathic medicine and sports medicine tracks. During her time in Grand Rapids, she served as the peer-nominated chief resident of research, quality improvement, and patient safety for 2 years, in addition to co-chief resident of the family medicine residency. She then transitioned to Edward Via College of Osteopathic Medicine, Virginia Tech, where she completed her osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine residency and is currently completing her primary care sports medicine fellowship. She credits her family, friends, and mentors to her achievements, like being selected as KCU's A.T. Still Medallion Memorial Award recipient at graduation, and the American Academy of Osteopathy's 2023 Osteopathic Resident of the Year. She has a strong passion for ensuring the art of osteopathic medicine is not lost by continuing to teach current and future osteopathic physicians. She has also used her undergraduate minor in Spanish to visit the Dominican Republic and Guatemala for multiple global medicine trips, where she performed and taught primary care and osteopathic medicine for this underserved patient population. Her interests include osteopathic medicine, sports medicine, academics, global health, orthobiologics, and integrative medicine. We welcome to the podcast this evening Dr. Nicole Frimerick, D.O.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to finally get to do this with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear your story, and thanks for taking the time. We are 2 days away from Christmas Day, so I'm not sure what your schedule is, but I'm sure it's busy. So thanks for carving some time out to tell your story.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Anytime.
So, yeah, we're excited to have the AAO Resident of the Year on the podcast. And if you had to describe yourself in a sentence or two for the audience, how would you do that? I know that that's a tough question to start out with, but
that is a tough question. We're just like going in head first. I love it. So, you know, I'm going to actually, it's funny that we're on an osteopathic podcast because, you know, when you live in this osteopathic world, it kind of becomes a part of you. And so I will give credit to a colleague of mine. I remember when we were fellows together, Dr. Elizabeth York, she's a PM&R doctor now. She asked this question, and I have continued to ask it of applicants and people in the OMM world, and I find it fascinating. So she would ask people, if you could be any OMM technique, what would you be and why? And I think my answer describes the answer to your question. And I always said cervical HVLA, a little bit loud, a little bit intimidating, but at the end of the day, always there for you and always helpful. So that would be my sentences for me.
Loud, intimidating, but always there for you.
Yes.
Cervical HVLA is the technique that defines you.
Yes. See it as a little intimidating. You know, students often don't want to approach that topic. And I get told sometimes that I've got a big personality. And so, and then I always get told that I'm loud, which I feel like cervical HVLA always makes the most noise. And so, you know, I think, but at the end of the day, you always walk away feeling like you're moving better and well supported. Right. So, you know, I think it's perfect for this topic.
I love that response. That's That might be one of the best responses I think I've heard.
Well, you can thank Dr. York for yourself. That question when we would interview candidates to work at Kansas City or fellows the following year. That was her question that we asked, and I have carried it on since 2018. So
that's great. That is awesome. Follow up to that. Movie or documentary recommendation?
Well, this is probably going to swing a little bit to the Ted Lasso side of things, but in the sports side of things, but that would be my recommendation would be is Ted Lasso. If you have the opportunity to rent or do like a 1 month subscription to like Apple TV, that would be my go-to. It would be Ted Lasso. It's 3 seasons of just wholehearted support. And that's not a documentary or a book or a movie or anything in particular, but it is just one of my most favorite shows I've ever seen.
What makes you love it? I actually have never seen it. I know you dressed up as Ted Lasso for Halloween.
I did.
And I know it's about sports, but I don't know any more than that.
Yeah. So it is a show originally, like the first episode, basically it is about a soccer team in England. And he coaches football from the United States, right? So football in the U.S. versus football in England, two very different sports. And they bring the owner of the club brings him in because she basically wants to destroy her now ex-husband's team. That was his empire. And come to find out that after just a few episodes, he's like super influential and he's just so positive. And it has just this most beautiful comedy. There's just like a lot of really good messages in it, of teamwork and building and how good coaching and support systems can really grow you as a person and as a group. And so it's just one of my most favorite shows I've ever seen.
Cool. Ted Lasso, Apple TV. Okay.
Highly recommend.
Put that one on the list.
Absolutely.
What about a book recommendation? I'm rapid firing questions off at you.
I love it. Bring it. So I'm not the biggest of readers. Ironically, I have heard it's pretty mixed. I feel like in medicine, people either go back to their love of reading or they just never were huge readers. But one book that has always kind of stuck with me that I read growing up was, it's a autobiography with, about Walter Payton. And it's a great book, and I'm blanking on the quote, of course, right as I said it. Tomorrow's Not Promised to Anyone. I'm sorry. There it is. So yeah, it's a book. It's called Tomorrow's Not Promised to Anyone, and it's all about Walter Payton and his journey. And that has been a family quote of mine ever since that book came out when I was in my younger years. And it was a great book, and I still remember it.
I love that phrase. I mean, wow. Tomorrow is Not Promised to Everyone is the title.
Yeah. Tomorrow's Not Promised to Anyone, and it's about Walter Payton. And yeah, it's a great, what has been one of kind of my family quotes. We've got a couple movies and quotes in my family that have kind of always stuck around since growing up, and that's one of them. So
yeah, that's a powerful quote. Now, Walter Payton, he died, what kind of, was it liver cancer?
Liver cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I had the opportunity growing up for about 13 or 14 years. My family, since being from growing up in Chicago, my family and I actually worked with the Walter County Payton Foundation most of my youth, and got to meet his family, and they're all just wonderful people. So it's a great organization if you're ever looking to help as well. It's the Walter and Connie Payton Foundation, and they help kids with like inner city Chicago and just all different stuff. So they're just a wonderful family.
That's awesome. Yeah. What was that experience like for you as a kid volunteering in the Walter Payton Foundation?
You know, I joke that, like, I think I came out of the womb wearing blue and orange, because, you know, there were days that, you know, I was sick as a dog. My dad loves to remind me of this story. And, you know, we were going to the Bears games and he was going to go and my mom and I were going to stay home. And I was like, no, they need their best cheerleader, you know, and I was 2 or 3 years old. And so getting the opportunity to work with a family that, you know, you see on TV and you hear about the name and all of those things, but then to also hear like and meet and experience how wonderful of human beings they are also, it just kind of speaks to it. And I think I met Walter once or twice growing up.
you know, and I'm sure he's met a million and one people, but yeah, it was a phenomenal experience getting to work with them.
That's cool. So, I mean, is your life story going to play out full circle where you're going to become the sideline sports med physician for the Chicago Bears someday?
You know, I always said the dream job would be to work for the Bears. And then I moved to Kansas City and I said, well, the Bears or the Chiefs would work. You know, I just love, I love them both. And they both got special places in my heart. So, you know, that would be a pretty cool to come full circle to that kind of involvement in the sports world.
Yeah. I also know, or we had talked about you during your O&MM fellowship year. Dr. Kozar had you guys read From the Dry Bone to the Living Man, the book by John Lewis. Is that correct? What did you think about that book?
That also is, you know, I was trying to think of more fun things, but that book
is, I think
that book should be built into curriculum somehow in medical schools, because it is just one of the most well-written books about osteopathic medicine and really pulling together a lot of pieces and putting it together in a very readable way. And so, I think every student should have to read it at some point during medical school, maybe, you know, the summer between first and second year or something like that. But that's an exceptional book. I believe you've read that one as well, right?
Yeah, I read that one. Yeah, my first year of O&MM residency. Quite impressed with it. I mean, also just to learn about the history of John Lewis writing that book. I think he took 7 years of his life to research Still's life and to travel. I think he's from Wales. He lived in the U.S. for 7 years in Missouri and was reading the original writings and going to the historical sites and talking to family, talking to friends and interviewing them. And it really is a masterpiece. I went on Amazon Books, I think 2 nights ago, because our residents, we have like $1,500 of CME money. And I was like, this might be a good way if we could get a copy to each one of the residents. But it was like $150 and there's only one copy left.
So if you actually go directly on his website, he will send them to you. And if you ask, he'll sign them too sometimes. So
what's the website?
I can definitely look it up and send it to you after the podcast. I don't have the website
with
me, but if you just look up like John Lewis, it actually sends from the UK, I believe.
I wonder if it's Dry Bone Press.
That sounds familiar. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds very
familiar. Yeah, we'll look that up. That would be okay. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we know you're a diehard Bears fan, HVLA, cervical HVLA defines who you are as a person. you're fun loving, love life, enthusiastic. What made you choose medicine as a career?
That is a great question. So, when I was younger, I always wanted to be a doctor, but I actually wanted to be a veterinarian doctor. I loved animals, always said I would love it. And my junior year of high school, I took a course called Introduction to Sports Medicine at Providence Catholic High School, a little shout out there. And we worked with our athletic trainer, who was the one who taught the class. We called him TP. His name was Trainer Pat. So we that's what we called him. And we were supposed to spend about 2 hours a week in the training room. And I usually spent closer to the 20 hours a week in the training room because I just loved the environment and the experience. And that was what really kickstarted my journey, was actually knowing I thought I wanted to go into sports medicine. So I went into college and vet was still teeter tottering in the back of my brain. But at the end of the day, I decided, you know, I can go to medical school and be a doctor and I can still have the animal piece. By donating to shelters or, you know, having animals myself or rescues. And, you know, if I went into vet, there wasn't really anything with sports medicine that I could do. And so I actually was one of the lucky few in medical school who went into medical school thinking they were going to do primary care sports medicine and came out. Here we are about 15 years later doing just that. So,
yeah, you know, I look back on your career trajectory and I'm like, Nicole definitely took the long route. She was an OMM fellow, and then you're just constantly taking on more responsibility and, you know, wanting more education. And you're just like one of those people that I just feel like loves to educate themselves, help educate others, and take on a lot of tasks.
Yeah, that taking on tasks has been my biggest probably blessing and curse in life. Is just, you know, you're absolutely right. I love to learn. I love to teach. And the more experiences and opportunities I have for that good support system, I think bodes itself well to teaching, you know, future generations. And but at the same time, you're right. Taking on something, I tell students, is you have to remember when to say no. And that's something that, you know, is a lifelong journey for me, is figuring out when and where to say no, because there's a learning opportunity. And my current program director says all the time, there's a learning opportunity everywhere around you. And so you just got to pick and choose which ones you have the ability to take at that time.
Yeah. You mentioned that you loved sports. You loved the environment of the training room. What was it about the environment that you loved?
There was something about the passion of the athletic trainer who I worked most closely with, the coaching staff, the parents, the athlete, and ultimately those patients, they all want to get better, right? And I had my own fair share of injuries growing up. I did competitive cheer and dance for about 18 years, but switching between the two sports, and had my fair share of injuries and things maybe not handled the way I would handle them today. And, you know, I felt like there was just something magical about the environment. And it's hard to put a word on it until you know what that feels like. And I'm sure there are people who do OB-GYN who have that magical moment when they're doing a delivery or surgery, when, you know, they are able to finish, you know, a really complex surgery. And there was something magical for me in the sports medicine world. And then in those first couple of months of OMM lab, that really just kind of sparked things for me.
Yeah. So was it the training room experience and working with that athletic trainer? This was in, was this in undergrad or
high school? My junior year of high school.
Okay. Where you thought, okay, I'm going to go into human medicine, not animal medicine. Was it the training room experience? Because I know you love animals, and you got to talk about Loki before the podcast is done.
Well, I mean, that's easy. Don't get me started on that till the end, because we know I could be here for days doing that. But yeah, it really was that experience. And I really didn't make my final decision, because I had always wanted to be a vet. Like, I had always wanted to do it. And I really didn't make that final decision until probably about halfway through my first semester of college. And then that was kind of when I really decided. I shadowed a vet, and I just realized that there were pieces of veterinary medicine that I think I loved animals a little too much to do. And, that I really felt like when I was in a medicine, human environment, sports medicine, that kind of hands-on holistic approach, that was really where my heart best served. And I think that's really what finalized it. But I really, truly, the switch came from, I think I knew once I did that course, my junior year of college, high school, I think I knew at that time that this was it, but I don't think I accepted it until maybe a year and a half or 2 years later.
I see. Okay. And I already mentioned Loki, and people are probably wondering who or what is Loki? So if you want to talk a little bit about Loki, that'd be great.
Yeah. So Loki is, I call him my soul animal. So Loki is a now 4-year-old Maltese Yorkie, or Morky. Yes, we're talking about you. He's sitting right next to me. And when I said that, he looked right up at me. And so he, funny enough, I had known for about, we talked about, I loved animals. So 6 or 7 years, I had known I was going to get a dog after my level one boards towards the end of my intern year. That was the plan. And I always grew up with 120-pound Rhodesian Ridgebacks, and Loki is actually a 7-pound, little pup. And so I never thought I would get someone that small, but he's been phenomenal, and I love it because I get to travel with him everywhere I go. And funny enough, I took my boards at the end of January, my intern year, and I was just looking for dogs online, and he popped up on a Facebook page when I would have been at Convocation in 2020. However, there was this thing called the pandemic that happened. And our hospital system told us we couldn't fly the day before our flights. So we ended up not going to the conference. And at the time that I would have been flying back is when he popped up on the Facebook page as available because someone was moving and couldn't take him. And it was the best universal accident that I think has ever happened for me. And my dad drove up to Grand Rapids that night and we went and got him the next day. And then the world shut down that Friday. And funny enough, I was put on kind of online electives and just clinic time. So I was pretty much home with him for about 6 weeks, except for an occasional half day here or there during that COVID time, which was my intern year. And needless to say, I think there was a little bit of separation anxiety on both of our ends when I had to go back to work. But yeah, he's well loved here and he gets to come to clinic sometimes. And but he's he's the light of my life for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. He was your companion during the pandemic and an incredible companion continues to be. That's yes. Awesome.
And I know you've gotten the chance to meet him. And
I did. So. I got to take care of him. And
you did.
So you talked about how you loved hands-on medicine. You love the training room. Is that what led you to osteopathic medicine or DO school?
Yeah, that's also a great story. So funny enough, I think it just the universe tells you where you're supposed to be. And I actually had one of my best friends in undergrad. Her name was also Nicole. So we were known as the Nicoles. And she is now a surgeon. And so we had both known we were going to be applying to med school and, as did a couple of our other friends and we were different majors. And so there was a night that I was studying for an exam that she didn't have. And she went to like a pre-med seminar and came back to our apartment and said, you need to look at DO schools. They're perfect for you. They fit you. And I was like, okay, like, sure, I'll look, you know, right. Cause no one really talks about that. I feel like in undergrad. And so I put my mom, who was a pediatric intensive care nurse at the time, I put her on the watch of looking for any differences between the MD and DOs, colleagues that she worked with as a nurse, and asking them their comments and feedback. And then I started to look into it more. And so I applied kind of broadly to mostly the state of Illinois MD schools, just to, you know, be within my home state and home area. And then I applied to DO schools kind of all over the place. And ended up interviewing, funny enough, at Kansas City on December 6th. Don't ask me why I know that. I think it was just an important date in my life. And so I remember it. And that was my first medical school interview. And I don't think we ever turned back from that. So
what was it about your interview at KCU that really caught your eye?
I wish I could go back and kind of be a fly on the wall that day. There was just something about the people and the environment and the way they talked about medicine that really struck me as special. And then, you know, hearing one of my best friends who, you know, you spend all your time with in undergrad be like, I think this fits you. And knowing what my major was, which was interdisciplinary health sciences, which I think, as you mentioned, is that kind of 30,000 foot view of being a human and health. And I think that really spoke to the osteopathic school and hearing that and kind of connecting the two pieces. I think it really, it just made sense and it's just continued to open itself up to why it made sense. So,
yeah. So after you got in, did you have much exposure to osteopathic manipulation or was first year of medical school your first experience with that?
First year of medical school was my true first experience. I did shadow a DO and he did a little bit and talked to me a little bit about it, but really my first experience was during medical school.
What was that experience like for you?
Goodness. So I always think back to some of my faculty and one of them actually was an undergraduate fellow. And for those maybe on the podcast that don't know what that fellowship is, it's essentially you pause medical school for a period of time or you alternate depending on the school and your med school turns into 5 years. And so at our school, we taught clinical medicine and osteopathic medicine. And my fellow, when I was a first year student, Brett Sprouse, who now is a VCOM faculty down and works with Auburn and did a sports medicine fellowship through Auburn. He was my faculty, and he's this 6 foot something. Just, I call him my big brother all the time. And he would come up and he'd put his arms right around me to help me feel what I needed to feel or help feel what the positions needed to be. And he was always around in lab as were his co-fellows, but him and I really bonded over the osteopathic sports medicine piece. And then getting to work with a lot of the other faculty, it really kind of just took off from there. And I was that person that people would text, myself and one other student, and during our second year, we would get texts during class like, "Hey, can you treat my rib at the break? Or hey, can you treat my neck? I've got a horrible migraine." And so that was really where I got my hands-on experience, was just word of mouth from classmates. So
nice. So your fellow, he was an incredible mentor. Mm-hmm. You guys bonded over primary care sports medicine. Was his role modeling what helped you decide that, yes, I too want to be an OMM fellow?
He was a huge piece of what made me be an OMM fellow. And I remember sitting down with my best friends, Grace and Katie, and one's an orthopedic surgeon and one's a joint specialist and one's a GI internal medicine. And I remember sitting down with them when applications were due for the fellowship, and they're like, "Nicole, you need to do this." And I was like, "But I won't graduate with you guys." And they're like, "So? You can use all of our knowledge to your advantage when you do go apply." And, you know, and they were just like, "You are meant to do this." And between them and some of my faculty that were just incredible mentors at KCU, I think kind of the combination of all of those together really just kind of kept the ball rolling.
You were the student, like you said, that people went to if they had neck pain, rib pain, like, "Oh, I got to go see Nicole."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I feel like a lot of us in the OMM world, it's when you start using it is and actually being like, "Oh, that worked." And when you do it well, or you're willing to do it, you know, not a lot of people wanted to HVLA someone's neck. Funny to speech back to, you know, and in reality, it's true. We get a lot of students who say, you know, they're nervous to do it. And when you find someone who is willing to do it, you know, that gets out pretty quickly. And so I feel like, you know, that kind of spreads, and that's where I got a lot of my hands on.
Got it. What was there anything in particular that you can pinpoint about OMM or OMT that you loved?
Oh, that's a loaded question, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
As a student, you mean as a student, really?
Yes. When you were a medical student, first, second year, and you were learning the hands-on, was it that you were treating people and they were getting better and you're like, "Oh man, like there's something to this," and then you started doing it more and learning more about it?
I think a little bit of that, but honestly, some of it I think was myself getting better. I think I got treated and realized, you know, as someone who has a lot of TMJ troubles, I have some hypermobility, I had migraines, and actually feeling better and seeing how much it helped me feel better with those things, I think that was a big key also, getting to actually experience it, but also getting to see the light bulbs, which is one of my favorite things when I teach too, just seeing students' faces kind of light up when you do a counter strain technique where they only had, you know, 3 minutes for a practical and didn't hold seconds and follow through their treatment. I think that, you know, actually seeing those light bulb moments, both personally on my own body, but also on others, I think was really the big key.
Yeah. I feel like that's, you hit the nail on the head. Because I've often asked myself, you know, why is it that we don't have more osteopathic medical students going into our specialty? Where is this disconnect? And I think that it's, yes, like you say, if you have true pain and discomfort from old injuries, old sprains, fractures, whatever that may be, and you get treated with OMT and you start to experience in your own body the benefits, then you realize, yes, wow, this can be a very powerful tool for the right patient. Or you're shadowing or working with an OMT practitioner who is treating patients in the outpatient setting or inpatient setting, and you're actually seeing the patient subjectively say, hey, this is really helping me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like those are the two real key experiences for students. And it sounds like, you know, that was your experience.
Yeah. And I would even add to that, I think getting to see it in practice in like a flow, I feel like, you know, we teach a lot of technique-based medicine and osteopathic medicine because that's the best way to do it in the model that we have right now of teaching. But, you know, getting to see that kind of flow of how you actually treat a patient. You don't just do, I'm going to do muscle energy to the pelvis and you talk out loud and you're only going to do that one thing because that's the station, I think is also key. So, you know, I've always said if I ever end up back in academics, which is definitely something I'm very interested in, but I'd love to bring either staff in who are willing to kind of share some of, you know, their background and story, but actually just like demonstrate once a month or once every other month in front of the whole class, like a whole treatment, like a normal visit, rather than just the kind of like bulletproof lenses that they have of kind of one straight line of an idea and actually see how maybe we adapt things or change things to that patient.
Yeah. A real patient, real pathology, and how you would go through your thought process and your treatment plan.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. That's a great idea. Okay.
You're welcome to steal it if you ever get into academics as well.
You know, I, at some point, I hope to always dabble in academics, but I feel like I'm going to be that guy. I'm like that 80-year-old grandpa in the room just sharing, you know, with putting in my dentures and getting up in front of the class and, you know, sharing my clinical experience.
I love it. You're the guy that maybe is not writing test questions, but everyone loves to hear their clinical stories.
Probably. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be, you know, I'll be falling asleep and snoring when the other person's lecturing because I can't stay awake. I'm
right,
so old.
Right.
You know? But yes. Okay. How was your experience third and fourth year in the clinic? Were you able to use or continue to use your OMT skills?
So I was very lucky in the rotations that I had to have the opportunity to use them. But also, I think something that is a really hard balance to learn. And like I said, I can sometimes be a big personality, but sometimes that works to my benefit when there were times that I would be on a rotation. One I can particularly remember. So my very first month of rotations, I was at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City. And there was a patient that we saw that I thought would benefit from OMM. And we had a brand new attending, not new to medicine, but new to the hospital system, that was an MD. And she had no idea what OMM was. And I kind of just explained it to the resident first. You know, you always go through your steps, but talk to the resident. And they were like, I mean, that's fair. You can ask her. And I kind of told her, I was like, I wouldn't do any popping or cracking techniques, but I would love to. If you're okay with it, you know, she's been admitted a couple times. And she was like, okay, like, I don't really know what I'm agreeing to, but sure. And I found a way to treat in a pediatric hospital on my first month of rotations, just by asking, and, you know, educating other people. And maybe that opened up a world to something down the road. You know, I don't know. I was only there for 4 weeks, but, you know, I found ways and opportunities to treat and asked, you know, when I could, and tried to learn when it was appropriate to ask and when not. And, definitely on like my outpatient months, really tried to be able to do that. And then I also had this awesome opportunity during my rotations, which again, I said, I was very lucky that the universe put me with the people that they put me with, because during my surgery month, I was actually down in a small town in Kansas, where I stayed, you know, it was a few hours from home and they housed you and everything. And he had done the osteopathic medicine fellowship at KCU years before I did. And he's a general surgeon. And so he would see in his clinic a gallbladder removal follow-up, and his next visit would be an OMT appointment. And so I had a lot of really cool opportunities to get to see those kinds of things that I think just helped reinforce my interest in it that much more.
Yeah. Going back to that first patient encounter in the pediatric or children's hospital, what did the MD, what was their reaction after you completed the treatment?
She was kind of just like, I'm glad she feels, I don't think she entirely knew what I did or what I was doing. And I think, luckily it was something that I'd like to think that the patient and the mom felt very pleased, because the mom had been like, no one's offered this yet. And I do think that there's some mechanical piece to what's going on. And so she seemed pleased with it. And that was kind of the end of the conversation. You know, I think it was probably a Thursday, Friday, and I wasn't on the weekend, and that patient got discharged. But, you know, it was a cool opportunity to get to try, and I do that anywhere I can, as I feel like most of us do, is teach a little bit about what OMM is or where it can help people and patients, and whenever we have the opportunity.
Yeah. Reading through your biography that you sent me, I love that sentence where you talk about your strong passion for ensuring the art of osteopathic medicine is not lost.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, and I really applaud you for that. It really is an art, right? It's people jokingly, but not jokingly, I feel like I'm wizard or magic hands, or, you know, wave your magic wand. That makes me functional and makes me move.
I feel like it might be the specialty in medicine that is the most, I guess, if we want to use the word art-like, because I don't know that we have really great objective measures for outcome. You know, I guess you could measure range of motion improvements. You could possibly, with MSK ultrasound and elastography, look at like tissue elastography. But a lot of, at least now, from what I have seen in my experience and what I've heard, is the patient saying, my pain is less, my range of motion is better, you know?
Mm-hmm. So I like to think about too, I've grown into this statement of telling patients that I love to be a miracle worker and make things completely go back to the way they were with no pain. I love when that happens once in a while, but I said, my goal is ultimately to get you to function better and have a better quality of life. And that might not be getting pain completely gone, and that's okay, but it's getting us either comfortable with pain or recognizing how to manage it, or, you know, treating it to make that range of motion better. It might not be perfect. It might not be how it was before the injury or the car accident or, you know, the 20 years of migraines, but if it's better and your quality of life is better and your function of life is better, then I think at the end of the day, I did my job.
Yeah. Yeah. I also have found that it's important, I think, to put the onus on the patient to do the heavy lifting. I like to just tell them very clearly, hey, this is 20% me, this is 80% you. You know, I'm here to try to help figure out what the cause is of your discomfort and your pain, try to figure out the underlying cause and give you the tools and the education to resolve this to the best of your ability and our ability as a team. But
yeah, no, I agree. I think our field definitely bodes itself well to the definitely having more of an art. I think everyone has an art, you know. I by no means can do the surgeries and the skin closures and things as well as maybe a plastic surgeon might, or, you know, make sure I've got all the margins of a, you know, cancer or something like that. But I think there's an art to every piece, but we definitely have this, a different gift, as my co-resident and good friend of mine, Alicia, always says, you know, everyone has a gift, and you have to figure out what your gift is and how to use it. So,
yeah, absolutely. At the same time, I think that it would be helpful if we had some more objective measures. I'm not sure exactly what those are at this time, but if we had more objective measures, it might be a little bit easier to communicate with other specialties or the MD community.
Yeah. And I think what's been helpful I've seen is, you know, we have at VCOM, we have a couple MD faculty that actually teach in the OMM department, even in lab all the time. And it's fascinating to get to hear their side of things, to be like, you know, we didn't learn any of this and had to seek it out on our own. So I think, yeah, any time there's that opportunity, and the more osteopaths,
hopefully we get more influence to for people to explore the osteopath word community and world and use of OMM. You know, not everyone has to be a specialist, but, you know, all DOs can do OMM. Then I try to emphasize is, you know, if we can get more people doing it and using it, then maybe there's more room and growth and ideas to develop those.
Absolutely. Can you walk us through your thought process when you were going to choose residency? Did you kind of always know I'm going to do FM, I'm going to do OMM, and then I'm going to do sports?
Yeah, I was always pretty sure that that was the plan. That was, like I said, I was one of the lucky ones that came in thinking that. So I really thought primary care sports med, and I loved how OMM integrated into that. And then kind of, as we've kind of all the stuff we've talked about build and grew and my time as a fellow, as all those things kind of grew and built, I fell in love with OMM. And so I did dabble in the idea of doing physiatry or PM&R. And you know, there were a couple of things that kind of I used to narrow down that path. And one of them was I could do PM&R if I wanted to do OMM in sports for sure. If I did PM&R, it would be a 6-year track. If I did all three, and if I did family medicine, it would be a 5-year track. So that saved me a year on that end and kind of made up for the OMM fellowship year. If you think about it at the end of the, you know, physician's career years. I also thought about, you know, for me, I had a mentor when I worked with the Chicago Rush Arena football team. He told me, you know, athletes don't just get hurt. They get sick too. They have asthma, they have diabetes, they have sinusitis, they get ear infections. And so that really always stuck with me when I thought about PM&R. I loved my time on PM&R. I had an outstanding rotation that really did tempt me. And, but that little quote really stuck in the back of my head. And then kind of the third thing was I at the end of the day, my best case scenario for a PM&R OMM sports practice versus a primary care sports practice, OMM sports practice, really, they looked very similar. Procedures, ultrasound, you know, musculoskeletal pain, athletes. But I had to think about some of the differentiating features. And one of them was a faculty told me, you know, you're not always guaranteed fellowships. And when she would talk about her story, and I thought, okay, well, what if I didn't get my fellowships? Like, what would my day-to-day look like as, you know, a primary care osteopathic physician versus a primary, you know, a PM&R osteopathic physician who doesn't get sports or doesn't end up doing an OMM? And, you know, really my quote scenario for me, right, everyone's is different, was for primary care was maybe covering my local high school, still seeing the ankle sprains for my primary care patients, still treating when I can and going to convocation and learning where I can. And in PM&R, my worst case scenario to me was working an inpatient rehab center and that being my primary role. And that was just not my passion. And so that was another one of my kind of defining factors of which path to choose. My best case scenario looked equal. So how do I differentiate that? And so one of them was, and that's what I tell students too. So,
yeah, I think that's wise. I think that's very wise to be realistic. Okay. I would love to get into an OMM fellowship and sports medicine fellowship, but that's not guaranteed. So what's the plan B? What is the worst case scenario? Yeah. What does that look like? And play that out in your mind.
Yeah.
Because it could happen.
Yeah. I've seen it right. Happen.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think that's very wise. I think that's really wise and great advice. So thankfully, your dreams all came true.
They have, with a lot of hard work and late nights and a lot of those saying yeses, should I say.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just so impressed. I mean, you did the OMM fellowship. So you did an extra year of medical school. You were teaching, but it's still an extra year of medical school.
Mm-hmm.
You were chief resident at your family medicine residency. Then you did the OMM residency with Dr. Kozar at VCOM, moved to Virginia, and now you're doing the sports medicine, primary care sports medicine with Dr. Rogers there at VCOM as well. Can you talk to us a little bit about, let's just say, some highlights in each one of those moments in your life? So family medicine, OMM, and now in sports.
Oh, yeah.
I'm throwing loaded questions at you, Nicole, because I know, I mean, you said you define yourself like cervical HVLA, so I know you're ready for anything.
I am. So, you know, I think each step loans itself to making this like perfect puzzle piece. And I think you don't ever have a good puzzle without losing a couple pieces and realizing you can't until you find those pieces, or a piece gets bent and you have to flatten it out and work through those things. And, you know, I had the unique experience in my family medicine residency, COVID really impacting it and some hospital things and changes that, you know, really changed my persona in the family medicine world. And I think something that really spoke to me during family medicine was really connecting with patients on a totally different level. I think one of my most profound experiences was I had a patient of mine, and I had had him for about 2 years, and he was just not well off in the world. The universe was not working in his favor. And getting a phone call about halfway through my OMM year, when I had left Michigan for 6 months, to tell me that he was still in his housing that we had gotten him, and he had just gotten approved for his disability and gotten his social security check. I mean, I started crying, because that left a big enough impact on his life that our work changed his life in family medicine. And so I think that was probably one of my most profound moments that I learned. Things aren't lost on anyone. You know, everyone has an opportunity to grow, even when they're at their worst, even when. And so sometimes I have to remind myself that at those days where you're tired, or, you know, you've got so many deadlines going on. Those are key things. In the OMM world, I think was just, it's something that I have to learn every day, but that has impacted more of my day-to-day life, is flow. And I think I really learned in my OMM time, both in my family medicine, but also primarily my OMM year here at VCOM, was how to just move with what you need to flow with. And I had a faculty tell me, you know, you got to start listening to what the body, what you think it wants. And I think that is a hard skill to learn, and something I by no means am a master at, but something that I have to think about kind of every day, of how can I use that thinking. And then I think in the sports world, not only just how our athletes work with us, but and to see how much our athletes and our athletic trainers and our coaching staff, you know, in the sports world trust us, it kind of reaffirms all of that kind of same thinking of, you know, nothing's lost on anyone. You have to have a network of trust, or some level of trust in people, and you have to be able to bend and flow with what you need to do and what the universe is giving you. So I would say that's probably my long-winded answer of those three things that is just, you know, spewing from my brain.
No, it's great. I love it. I mean, it's what's in the forefront of your thoughts.
Yeah.
That's great. What was it like to work and have Dr. Albert Kozar as your fellowship program director for ONMM? You know, I admire Dr. Kozar a lot. I admire how skilled he is, how masterful he is with the MSK ultrasound, and just his global knowledge of the human body and primarily the musculoskeletal system.
Yeah, I think the two best things I can think of are unreal and very humbling. I think you think you know a lot, and then you work with someone like him in the world of osteopathic sports medicine, and you realize there is a lot more I don't know. And then even to get to see him look up things that he doesn't know, you're like, wow, that is like way, you know, we talk about test questions and, you know, first order and second order and third order test questions when you're teaching, and he's at a whole different, you know, order level of thinking. And so I think that's really cool. But I really think the best part about getting to work with him and having met him and been brought here was actually what we talked a lot about in our program, was the diversity of all of our faculty. So, you know, we had four very diverse core faculty in our program. You have Dr. Kozar, who's just exceptional at
his knowledge of the anatomy is just out of this world. And then you've got Dr. Harden, whose knowledge and understanding of the student perspective is just, again, out of this world. He's been doing academics for so long, and he has that, you know, older style of treatment. And so you get that whole other vibe. And then you get Dr. Robinson, who's this just calm energy, who does acupuncture in addition to OMM, and getting to see that world and thinking. And then we have the incredible Dr. Toby, who's, I think, one of 12 or 13 pediatric OMM boarded specialists, who is just, if you want to talk about wizards, just a wizard with small humans, and is just incredible. And so I think really they each boded well, like, you know, we were talking about Dr. Kozar and the anatomy principles that he would build. And then you'd go work with Dr. Toby the next day, and she would be like, okay, that's great that you know what that looks like on the ultrasound. Now tell me what that looks like at the baby's level, like when they're born. Like, how many pieces is that occiput in, or their sacrum in? And so the four of them together really just created this outstanding network. And then, you know, I had a phenomenal basis working with Dr. Grunwald and Dr. Caldwell at University of Michigan Health West. But, you know, I think that the anatomy and the knowledge from him is just a foundation that I'm so grateful for.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I never had the opportunity to work with the other three faculty members there at VCOM. I think I met, who's the chair?
Dr. Harden.
Dr. Harden, yes. Mm-hmm. I met Dr. Harden.
Yeah.
But I didn't meet the other two. So yeah. That's
great. And I mean, what's even cooler is the opportunity then to just get to transition into this role with Dr. Rogers and Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Chung and Brolinson and all these people who have just are just incredible human beings and so well respected in the sports medicine world. And then to see how much and how valued they are in the system of Virginia Tech and at Radford and just their OMM skill and how they apply it to such a unique population in sports. I think I can't say how lucky and grateful I am to Dr. Kozar and Dr. Rogers and all of them for bringing me down here, because the universe really had a plan and it brought me to the right place. And I get reminded, you know, every once in a while of how lucky and grateful I am. So.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't sense any bias in your voice at all, Nicole.
No, none. I again, it's all gratitude. I've had a lot of people, from Dr. McLean, who now is at the AACOM, to Dr. Treffer at Kansas City. I mean, I've got people everywhere, you know. Those are just some OMM sports faculty, you know, and I could sit here for days and say thank you and list off to every name, and I'd probably miss people.
Yeah. I mean, I had the opportunity to rotate down there with you guys at the sports medicine program, and it was really cool to spend an afternoon with Dr. Kozar in the anatomy lab and learn some MSK ultrasound, but then also see how, like you were saying, Dr. Chung, Dr. Mitchell, Dr. Rogers, Dr. Brolinson, how it was so refreshing for me to see how much they appreciated and valued OMM or OMT in the treatment plan of the athletes there at Tech.
And so really cool. How much the athletes appreciate it, I think, is even cooler, right? You know, like it's unreal. You know, I just treated an athlete recently and he stood up, he's like, oh my gosh, I can stand straight. Thank you. And you know, these athletes are getting their bodies out of whack and pushing weights, and they have everything going through them with nutrition and sports psychology available and everything, you know, everything that they could need. And yet something that helps keep them going is us and our hands, not the medicine, not anything else, but it's pretty cool to get to see how much they value what we do too.
That's true. That's a great point. It is very, very cool to see.
I wish it was something that you saw in all sports, because I just don't see a world where you do sports medicine without OMM anymore. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, you know, and maybe the universe will put you in positions, I'm sure it will, to help grow the OMM sports medicine knowledge and spread that to hopefully other programs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other sports medicine physicians. That's great. What else, Nicole? Anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't touched on?
I think
you know, more so for, you know, I know the people who use OMM are in that 10%, right? They're the ones who use OMM. And I think something that I always like to remind people is that you don't have to be the specialist to do it. It helps, but you don't have to be the specialist. You learn enough skill to do things and have the opportunities to come to courses like Convo or, you know, do workshops and things like that at osteopathic conferences, that I really think there's no reason. And I just have this hope that with more schools that we'll see that number increase, but you know, there's some studies that show that less than 10% of DOs actually use any amount of OMM. And that just makes my heart hurt because there's so many patients that you can quickly do a couple of treatments for a carpal tunnel by looking at some ribs and thoracic and upper extremity in under 5 minutes and maybe make a huge impact. And I hope that the system of medicine continues to grow and build and recognize how valuable that can be and how valuable that therapeutic touch can be. And you know, we've all heard, who are in this world, have all heard those stories of the, I don't function without OMM and OMT and how important it is to their life and how it keeps them off narcotics. And, you know, it's just, it's cool. And I think what I like to tell people, my patients all the time, we bond over the body is weird. You know, the body has weird things and we get the opportunity to lay hands on it and treat it and really figure out what's wrong from the ground up. And I think that that's really cool. And so I just would love to emphasize to students and learners and people maybe considering osteopathic medicine to don't lose your skills, use them on family, friends, coworkers, co-residents, yourself, whatever it might be, so that you don't lose those skills, because you never know when they're going to come in handy for a patient that you wish you remembered how to do that mesenteric lift or whatever it might be.
Yeah, absolutely. And the cool thing is, you know, those tools are with you wherever you are.
Yeah. They don't cost anything extra to travel.
They don't. You don't have to pack a special bag for your toolkit. They're just part of your body.
They are. And there's so many avenues of using it. You know, I always joke with students. They'll be like, so are you doing muscle energy? And I'm like, well, I'm kind of doing muscle energy, but really I'm doing a BLT stills and muscle energy. And then we end with a little FPR. You know, there's so many ways to use it. It doesn't have to be just the rigid and using your principles. And so that's something I also emphasize to students a lot is use your principles. Know what your guidelines are and you can use them anywhere, anytime, any place. So
yeah, that's great. I love that. How, if I was to ask you, imagining your career 5, 10, 15 years down the road, maybe 20, how do you envision yourself ensuring the art of osteopathic medicine is not lost in your career?
I, you know, it's as that jobs search and that finally doing all those fellowships is coming to an end so quick.
Wait, you're not going to do another fellowship?
Not right now, at least. You know, I should probably get out to the real world and use all these incredible skills that all these people have taught me. You know, I see a world where I'm teaching in some capacity, whether that is at an academic institution, whether that is taking students, taking residents, taking fellows, but really trying to make sure that that art is seen in practice. Again, whether it's in a classroom, whether it's a reminder of that, because, you know, I feel like we don't always do the, we just give a lecture and walk away. And, you know, we got to remind people that we're also people and that we were in their shoes. And, you know, that I think is how you get them to hook into what you're saying is just show them that you're a human being and you're not just a lecture and test writing robot. And I think that makes a huge difference. And I think that is, I think, one of the biggest keys. And then I think doing things like, you know, I like to think that somewhere like Virginia Tech has this like integrated osteopathic focus that I've had the honor of getting to work in. And I would love to see and hope that as athletic trainers leave or players leave and go to the NFL or they go coach somewhere, they know how valuable it was to them that it continues to spread. And so I think that that is key is, you know, reminding those people when they leave to spread the word,
And I think that's all we can hope and ask for to keeping that art going.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I wish you the best in your endeavors to find a job. And I hope it's the job of your dreams. And I know you're going to do great things with the incredible education that you have received over these last, my gosh, I guess your whole life until now.
I know, it's crazy to think. I remember I was asked for my fellowship, actually interview here at Virginia Tech VCOM. And he said, what is a memorable moment for you that, like, what keeps you motivated? What keeps you going? And it was, I said, I've never been asked that, but the first thing that comes to mind is a picture of myself on the sidelines at my high school with my hair and makeup done from Palms from our pregame and halftime performance, but I'm in my sports medicine polo and khakis and covering on the sidelines. And I said, I think that photo and that girl is what keeps me going when I'm tired, when I decide to do another fellowship, because I think that's what motivates me. And I'm grateful and thankful for all of the faculty and staff and support. And like I said, I would love to sit here and list them all off, but they all know how grateful I am for so many of them to have helped get me to where I am.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. Any plugs, any other plugs that you want to make?
You know, I think take the chance, take the dive. And I think quality over quantity. You are better off doing things you are passionate about than trying to do so many things that you don't even know what you're doing anymore. And I think it's so easy to get caught up as a pre-med or a medical student thinking about residency and, you know, boards are pass fail now, what do I do? And you just want to be involved in 20 clubs and all those things. But in reality, like, any day of the week, it will get you farther if you are passionate about what you are doing and really just believe in what you're doing every day. That will mean so much more.
That's great advice. Do you mind if I include your email in the show notes so that people can follow up with questions or comments?
Sure. Yeah, that's totally okay with me.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for your time. I'm so excited to see what you're going to do in your future career endeavors.
You as well.
And I don't know, I guess maybe see you at Convo. I don't know if you're gonna make it this year or not.
We're pretty busy that week. We've got a bunch of events, so it's on the list, but we'll see. If not this year, then I'm hoping for the following year in Florida. I believe it's in Florida the following year. So
okay. Sounds good. All the best with the final, gosh, 6 months of fellowship, and send my regards to the faculty and the fellows.
I will.
We'll talk to you later.
Awesome. Thanks, Ben. Have a great day, and good luck to you if I don't talk to you.
Okay. Thanks, Nicole. You as well. Bye. Bye now. Hope you were able to take away a few clinical pearls from this conversation. If you would like to reach out to Dr. Fromerick, you may at nfromerick@gmail.com. You can find her email in the show notes. If you have any questions, comments, or would like to be on the podcast, please email the onmmpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Be well, be curious, and spread osteopathy.